Ministry.
The global war on Syria was and still is one of the few cases in history that highlights how several regional and Western regimes are involved in a conflict whose end is unknown. What do they want from Syria? Why this unending conflict? Syrians asked many questions, so did many people across the world who followed what happened in the country over the past 10 years. A decade later, Syria is still witnessing a bloody and brutal foreign intervention that ranges from sophisticated bombs to suffocating economic sanctions. The country has become a permissible arena for international conflict, in addition to internal and regional conflicts. Thus, the war, which began in the form of local acts of Wahhabi-funded terrorism, turned into a complex regional and international conflict that includes armies and militias. The same old U.S. interim national security strategy, whether it was Trump or Biden in office, is still in use. No matter the tools, the goals and strategies are the same, and its pillars, oil, Kurds, and the security of the Israeli regime, using crises the U.S. helped create as a method of conflict management. No U.S. withdrawals from the occupied region in the horizon. More like military repositioning and deployment while emphasizing America's role in shaping, or rather creating, a new world order with a military focus in both the Pacific region and the Middle East. Developments on the ground confirm that the American strategy is no longer confined to economic pressure like the unjustified Caesar's Act. Rather, it goes beyond that towards reactivating the occupation and increasing warmongering rhetoric against Syria. The aim is to pressure it to accept the conditions of the so-called opposition, which in reality are U.S. demands already previously rejected by President Bashar al-Assad back in 2003, when former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell brought them directly to Damascus immediately after the U.S. invaded Iraq. Biden now seeks to overcome the loopholes and confusion in dealing with the Syrian crisis during the Trump administration. Proof is how Daesh is back in action. Cutting the Syrian-Iraqi border is retained, and sanctions are to take a more tightening role as Israel continues its regular strikes targeting any form of resistance against illegal foreign intervention in Syria. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mala Osman. After a decade of unfathomable violence and human tragedy that has made Syria the West's defining war of the early 21st century, the fighting has tapered off, but the suffering hasn't. In 2011, Obama led the West in the largest adventure yet in West Asia, thinking that Syria looked like just another domino about to fall in the whirlwind of uprising sweeping the Middle East. 10 years later, President Bashar Assad is still there, leading the heroic Syrian Arab Army, which eliminated Western-backed Daesh terrorism from more than 70% of the country, as reconciliation and reconstruction define the upcoming decade for Syria. To discuss this issue with us from New York is a Syrian diplomat, Ms. Alia Al-Ali. Thank you for being with us, Alia. Now, during their open war on Syria, all throughout the past 10 years, the Americans continued to fabricate internal crises inside of Syria. They have occupied the eastern part of the Euphrates. They have plundered Syria's oil resources. They gave an open green light for Israel to bomb all sorts of facilities, hospitals, schools, you name it, inside of Syria, while suffocating the country with very harsh economic sanctions that could add up to collective punishment. How is it possible that the UN has not seen all of these violations yet?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. At first, I would like to say that for us Syrians, the passage of 10 years to the Syrian crisis does not call for celebrating the revolution as some are trying to portray the situation. Mm-hmm. It is with a heavy heart we remember this day as it marks 10 years of suffering for Syrian citizens after the United States, some Western and regional countries spent tens of billions of dollars in order to break up Syria and terminate its role in the region, especially in facing the policies of occupation and hegemony. So back to your question, the Security Council has primary responsibility under the United Nations Charter for the maintenance of international peace and security. Unfortunately, some of the member states, permanent member states at the Security Council, namely the US, UK, and France, have failed miserably in meeting this duty. It is no secret that they supported and are still supporting terrorist groups such as ISIS, Al-Nusra, HDS, etc. Mm-hmm. In all ways of support, be it funding, weapons, training, media, facilitating their infiltration into Syria, you name it. These very same countries are saving no efforts in prolonging this crisis in order to serve their own agendas at the expense of the lives of millions of innocent Syrians. On the other side, the situation, as gloomy and unbearable as is, would have been even worse if it wasn't for the support of the Russian Federation and China for Syria in this arena. Now, what our world needs today, and specifically under the umbrella of the United Nations, is constructive and courageous stances that distance the UN system from political and financial polarization. So when this happens, this distancing happens, the UN can find creative solutions for crises all over the world and avoid the disastrous effects of creative chaos policies and attempts to change legitimate governments.
Well, Adia, in the past 10 years, the policy of both Barack Obama and Donald Trump has failed to achieve tangible results in Syria, and that policy of isolating Syria and suffocating it with sanctions has also failed to bring about any sort of change, especially to the approach of the Syrian government towards any sort of a political solution in Syria. Why is Biden then just playing the same old cards that his predecessors used against Syria?
Yeah, so like unable to achieve that regime change militarily, the Western governments imposed brutal illegal sanctions, causing death and suffering of millions of Syrians, depriving them of food, medicine, housing, education, and other vital rights. These illegal, immoral, inhuman, unilateral coercive measures imposed against Syrians by the European Union, the United States, and other countries seriously amount to a crime against humanity. As a matter of fact, we all saw Trump go out, Biden come in, all that changes is the name over the door. So changing the administration apparently, or as it seems, doesn't mean changing the policies. Mm-hmm. Yet it is more important now than ever that those governments should look realistically at the situation, the current situation, to see what their hostile policies have led to. Then they should, after they look at the situation, they should take measures to correct those wrong policies and adopt new approaches, constructive approaches based on respect for the principles of international law, which allows the restoration of peace and stability in Syria and the region.
Well, the current U.S. administration's admission of the failure of the military maneuvers, if you will, against Syria, they are not enough for them to maybe turn on the page of their aggression against the Syrian nation. Rather, it means that they might actually seek to overcome certain loopholes when dealing with the Syrian crisis that Trump had fallen into. What are Syria's options here in the event of a renewal in the violence against Syrian citizens and the Syrian Arab army itself?
Yeah, you see, the resilience of Syrian people and their uniting behind their leadership have led to the failure of the destructive policies that were implemented during the last 10 years. So what the U.S. The U.S. will not be able to achieve what it failed in during the last decade, because at the end of the day, the Syrian people will exert every effort to defend their independence, sovereignty, and unity, and territorial integrity. And that's our one and only option.
Well, one of the recurring U.S. strategies that you keep seeing in Syria is their unconditional support to the Kurdish separatist Contras in the northeastern part of Syria, especially in the governorates of Hasakeh and Qamishli, where we saw a lot of blockading, a lot of besiegement of the people, of the civilians in those two governorates, especially in Hasakeh, where last month we saw the murder. That's what it is. They murdered a Syrian security officer in Qamishli, and then they wounded a lot of people also with the shots that they fired at the angry public that wanted this besiegement to be broken. This resulted, as I said, in death and injuries. How will the Syrian government respond to such provocations if it is repeated, especially from the Kurdish Contras, which, by the way, are also Syrian citizens, who fall under the law of the Syrian constitution?
Well, first, there's an undeniable fact that the U.S. illegal presence on the Syrian territories is going to end sooner or later. Same applies for their proxies, as the separatist Kurdish militias or other proxies. In the recent incident you talked about, we saw the Syrian civilians in that area strongly protesting these practices of the U.S. and their proxies. Mm-hmm. So what we really believe in, that this deep sense of national belonging will safeguard the area from future provocations and eventually contributes to ending the occupation. You talked about like Kurdish or the militias are, at the end of the day, they're Syrian. Of course, when we talk about Syrian people respecting their this sense of belonging to their country, mm-hmm. We don't specify each ethnicity or each group belonging to a different background. There are bad people and good people, and there are very a lot of Kurdish Syrians who would save no effort in saving the unity and independence of Syria. Mm-hmm.
That is what we wish to see for the upcoming decade for Syria: prosperity, peace, and unity among all Syrians. Thank you very much for being with us, Ali Ali, a Syrian diplomat with us from New York. Thank you for being there very early in the day. Ali, it's an honor to have you on with us. Please stay tuned. Now, next, we will continue talking about what the upcoming U.S. Administration will have in its pockets for the Syrian crisis after the break.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
President Biden's foreign policy already seems stuck in the militarist quagmire of the past 20 years. It's a far cry from his campaign promises, by the way, to reinvigorate diplomacy as the primary tool of U.S. foreign policy. In this respect, Biden's approach on Syria shows he's just falling into the footsteps of former President Barack Obama and Donald Trump, who both promised fresh approaches to foreign policy, but for the most part delivered more endless wars. Now, Biden resumes Obama's war on Syria in this following report.
Ten years, thousands of civilian deaths, nearly 10 million people forced from their homes, some displaced two or even three times since the war began, hundreds of hospitals and schools damaged or destroyed. The toll of a decade-long global war on Syria defies comprehension, a war that was triggered by Takfiri cults, which made way for blatant Western foreign intervention, has spiraled the debacle into one of the most devastating spectacles of brutal neocolonialism in the region of West Asia. The United States continues to impede the restoration of stability in the country through the imposition of economic sanctions. After its proxies lost most of its frontline advances, Washington is now using various methods of economic and political pressure on international bodies and organizations to turn a blind eye on the repercussions of such bans. A decade into the global war on the Levantine nation, the government in Damascus continues to make strenuous efforts to secure suitable and proper conditions for the return of Syrian refugees, reconstruct industrial and agricultural installations, create job opportunities despite the difficult economic situation in the country, all the while combating terrorism. Despite losing trust in what is known as the international community, Syrians who have suffered through the dreadful war and the continuous suffocating sanctions have yet to comprehend why no regional or international state dares to at least criticize the U.S. and its allies for their inhumane policies against Syria. Least they could do is call for embracing the international law and principles of the United Nations. However, it seems those laws and principles only apply on non-colonial states. The U.S. knows very well that the sanctions imposed on Syria target all Syrian people and obstruct the reconstruction process in the war-torn country. Biden knows that sanctions like the Caesars Act prevents the realization of a solution for humanitarian problems in Syria. This form of collective punishment, along with Biden's strikes on the Syrian border, is nothing short of a systematic terrorist campaign aimed at Syria's unity and territorial integrity.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Paris is Mr. Jean-Pierre Dutton, who is a political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Jean-Pierre. Now, on day one of his presidency, Biden revived Daesh terrorists inside Syria and reinforced their facilities in Tel Aviv, even flew them over from Hasakeh, from the prison, to attend base to allow them to start a new wave of attacks, both against the Syrian Arab army in that area, especially the route that gives way between Deir ez-Zor and Palmyra, and also against people, against the civilians, the Syrian civilians. What could come out of this old American ways? Any good of that?
I will tell you something, like I looked yesterday or maybe 3 days ago about what's happened with the European money. Don't talk about the American money. We spent millions of dollars, and American also, just to do one thing, to totally destroy a country and to make it go back, you know, to like the Middle Age for nothing. Like all these stories for nothing. No, it's not for nothing, to be totally exact. Mm-hmm. Because if you want to be clear, like the money we sent and the money like Americans are sending and like all the stuff we are doing there are helping a lot of the terrorists that we have inside in Europe, in US, because we discovered like many years ago, but it's not like recent, that the cash that we are sending to Syria now is coming back to France or to Europe or to America mm-hmm. by car bombings and by terrorist attack and all that. So this is the only way they are using. I mean, sending cash to people to make sure they're going to destroy our own country. This is what we're doing.
Well, that is very interesting thought right there. And we actually tried to portray that to the Europeans ever since that war began, but they weren't hearing what we are saying there, Jean-Pierre. But Biden's illegal airstrikes on Syria, especially on the border between Syria and Iraq, was on the 36th day of him being a president. And it obviously aimed at cutting off that route between Syria and Iraq with what it represents of economic prosperity for both countries, on top of which basically is the Al-Bukamal crossing, which is the biggest one of the three crossings on the border. Now, Syria and its resistance allies have lost a lot of very fine men, if I may say, to secure that route. Can Syria afford to lose it again, given the upheavals with the economic sanctions and the disastrous economy inside the nation right now?
I will tell you something, like when Joe Biden arrived at the White House, he came back with all the old ideas they had about Syria, that they still believe that there is something called, you know, people who are oppressed in Syria fighting against the regime. And it's not what we are seeing today. What we are seeing today is like terrorist groups who are using Western money to terrorize Syria. And when they finish to terrorize Syria, when they have some part time, we can say, they come to terrorize France, Europe, and US. So technically, attacking Syria like he's doing right now is not the first time that Western world and US and whatever, France or Europe, are attacking the country. The problem is, like, what's the point? Like, okay, I'm okay with all the strategy, but no one is explaining you what's the point. What's the point? The point of Joe Biden today is to tell that we don't want Bashar Assad anymore. Okay, perfect. What's the solution? What's the other option? What's the guy you are going to put in charge? What you are? What kind of guy in 10 years? You are 10 years now. What kind of guy in 10 years who had, like, the you can say, the authority to take the
Well, mind you, Jean-Pierre, that the people
country.
That they are striking there at the border are the same people, whether from the Iraqi resistance or the Syrian Arab Army, that have eliminated Daesh. So what really are they trying to do there?
I'm telling you, see, what I wanted to say is that it's always the same strategy. The strategy is the strategy of chaos. It's a strategy of chaos, and to make sure that the country will stay like that. That means in the middle age. Mm-hmm. The problem is, like, they don't want to have a peaceful place in the Middle East. They don't want to have a place in which Christians, Muslims, and all the religions can live together and to say to the rest of the world, look at us, we are living together, we don't have issue.
One very interesting issue that the Biden administration is working on reviving Daesh for it, and also reviving what they call the international coalition, especially in the areas occupied by the U.S. troops in the eastern part of the Euphrates, under the pretext, obviously, of fighting Daesh, but they've never did but what I know about the information that I have, they never did. But what is the point of reviving that coalition, the international coalition, foreign troops coming from foreign countries, to desperately save what's left of the Syrian oil fields and the gas fields? Aren't they never tired from looting and plundering other states, sovereign states' resources?
I will tell you something, the real target, you know that, you and me, I think everyone who have, like, a little bit of cleverness know that it's Iran. So this is a real issue. Like, they are trying their best to target Iran. And because they cannot go to Iran, they are trying to destroy whatever is around it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what they are doing right now. And the fact is, like, they are not thinking. What I like in your way of thinking is, like, you are trying to understand and to define the strategy. When you are in a strategy of chaos, you don't have strategy. The only strategy you have is just to make sure that the people around your principal, your main enemy, are, like, totally destroyed and not able to live, like, normally. This is what they're doing.
But Jean-Pierre, at this
look
point,
at Syria, look at
as
Iraq.
A French citizen yourself, would you be okay in sending French troops to the eastern part of the Euphrates in Syria?
I said from the first day of what they called the so-called uprising in Syria, that all we are going to do in this area will be for nothing. You are talking about an area who are older than us. You are talking about area who have been there before us. You are talking about area who have, like, a tradition and civilization. You talk about 1,000 years ago. You can talk about Amawiyin, Abbasiyin.
Mm-hmm.
Who are us, you know, like, to come and to say, like, listen, guys, we are going to teach you how to manage your country.
How to be
in
democratic, please.
Exactly.
How to have democracy in your low life.
I want to say that, like, at the same time that in France we were not using souls, in Syria at the same time they were doing surgery of eyes. So
mm-hmm.
just to make people understand what the difference was, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
after everything changed because of the Wahhabi system and because, like, they did a lot about destroying, like, everything about science and cleverness in Islam. But if we talk about the reality of, like, Islam at the beginning, it was a religion of science. And look what they did about it.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact is, like, in France, I'm telling you again, and people have to listen to that, like, we were not even using soap in the Middle Ages. And they were doing surgery for eyes in Syria. They have even places for crazy people in asylum and whatever. You know, like, this is the reality of the Umayyad civilization,
mm-hmm.
and we can talk about the Abbasiyin.
Mm-hmm.
So look what we were doing at the same time.
Jean-Pierre, it's always a pleasure and an interesting way to discuss what's going on in the region of West Asia when you have you on board. But unfortunately, that's the time that we have. I want to thank you very much, Jean-Pierre, Dutiong, political commentator, for joining us from Paris to talk about what might the U.S. and European administrations be thinking or have in their pockets as surprises, if they may, for the Syrian nation. Thank you for being with us, and may the next 10 years be full of serenity, peace, unity, and utmost resistance in the region of West Asia against any occupier and any colonizer.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, good deeds. In Quran, combination of good deed is used in a special expression and is of a specific importance, so that every accepted deed is not considered as good, but it is referred to every action which is supported by Allah and free from duplicity and narcissism among others. In other words, in Quran, God accepts the deeds of His servants. Good deed is the external reflection of real faith and is like a tree which is irrigated by faith to God, and it will yield benefits such as being freed from sins, make humans happy and pure life in this world and the other one. It must be noted that in some verses of Quran and narrations, there are various instances of good deeds, some of which are performing duties, obeying innocence, benefiting parents, and assisting others. On the other hand, factors such as atheism, arrogance, and obeying temptations are considered as barriers of good deeds. Remember, brothers and sisters, it's not that hard to perform good deeds in your life. Sometimes we make these very simple things very complicated. You know, all Allah expects is that you do the right thing for the right reasons with the right intentions. This is what is the definition of a good deed. And Allah is out there through His mercy to accept all your good deeds. He's waiting for you to act in order to please Him, and He's ready to accept. So just try out, you know, at a given point in time, try to perform one small good deed, you know, maybe drinking coffee with the right hand, except, you know, other than the left hand, you know, eating food with the right hand, right? These are all very small little good deeds that you can perform. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the good deeds and what comprises a good deed and how Allah accepts a good deed. We said it's not that complicated to perform a good deed. Sometimes it's very small, little, obvious things. Good deed is an action done for the sake of Allah's satisfaction, and it has no materialistic purpose and award expectation for it, and it leads to mental development and spiritual revolution. In religious expression, good deed is an action which is introduced as obligatory or recommended. You know, we have all heard about the wajib and the mustahab actions, right? They're all good actions, they're good deeds. In moral and mystical definition, though, it is an action by which mystic can achieve esteem position. Therefore, good deed is a qualified action which leads to spiritual development, moral growth, and approaching Allah in every aspect. See, if we make it the goal and the purpose of our life to perform good deeds, see how we're going to benefit from every action that we do. Because at the end of the day, we live in this world, we're going to do things, you know, it's not like, you know, we can just sit idly. Even sitting idly is a deed, if you would, right? Now, if you do it properly for the sake of Allah, every action that you carry out, you can benefit largely through that very action. It could be even sleeping. A good deed is not necessarily when you climb all the way up to the mountain, right? Or do something huge. No. Anything that is done properly at the right time based on the Islamic guidelines and for the sake of Allah with that right intention would actually benefit you a great deal. With this, remember, good deeds are easy to carry out. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In GDP terms, China is currently the second largest economy, although it is expected to displace the United States as the largest economy this decade. China was the only economy to grow in 2020. Further, the International Monetary Fund assesses that China's economy will surpass the United States in growth in 2021. And as recent events have shown, the United States itself is not immune from internal collapse. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Bernardon J. Wishart, author. This article is published under the heading, Is America Weaker Than China? Stay tuned for more. the United States is no longer qualified to speak to us from a position of strength, said the senior diplomat from the People's Republic of China to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a particularly frosty meeting in Alaska. Much to the Joe Biden administration's credit, it appears to be taking the potential threat that China poses the United States more seriously than it did during the contentious 2020 presidential campaign. Yet one must ask an uncomfortable question. What if China's representatives are correct? As David P. Goldman reports, American influence is fragile in several key Eurasian nodal points, and China has the capacity to hurt the United States in retaliation for American efforts to build an alliance to contain it. In other words, as America spastically pivots to Asia, China sinks toward its west. And the reason that China is even attractive to the powers along its western periphery is China's increasing power. Part of the problem is perception. The way that American policymakers measure national power is insufficient for the 21st century. Chinese scholars have developed a much better method to analyze the competitive power of a nation-state. Known as the Comprehensive National Power CNP Assessment, China's methodology for measuring the nation's power relative to those of its competitors helps to explain how China has evolved into a serious challenger to the United States and its allies over the last 30 years. American analysts should study the CNP methodology and apply that when assessing U.S. power relative to that of its competitors. During the Cold War, the Soviets used a similar methodology, which they referred to as the correlation of forces. This kind of analysis would help policymakers devise better strategies for responding to the all-out society challenges emanating from China and elsewhere. One notable version of the CNP comes from Chinese scholar Huang Shougang. Huang's variant comprises a material or hard power index, such as economic wealth, natural resources, science and technology, military might, spirit or soft power index such as political power, foreign affairs, culture, education, coordinated power index such as line of command, leadership in policy decision making, and finally environmental index such as international environment. Beyond that, Huang's version of the CNP assessment has an appraisal index system, which includes national strategy goals, political stability, and decision-making capabilities. Huang long argued that the United States would remain the world's preeminent power from 2000 until 2020. He predicted that by 2020, China would be second. This certainly appears to be an analysis conducted over many years by Huang and his fellow scholars of national power at China's Academy of Military Science, AMS. The CNP model notwithstanding, since 2014, China became the largest economy in terms of purchasing power parity, that is PPP. In GDP terms, China is currently the second largest economy, although it is expected to displace the United States as the largest economy this decade. China was the only economy to grow in 2020. Further, the International Monetary Fund assesses that China's economy will surpass the United States in growth in 2021. American tech entrepreneurs like Elon Musk believe that China will become the world's largest economy this decade. This is a far cry from a decade ago, when many Western analysts were warning of China's coming collapse. There are certainly downsides to China's rapid development that could impinge on long-term growth, although these negative effects have yet to be fully experienced, as evidenced by China's continued growth. And as recent events have shown, the United States itself is not immune from internal collapse. It all comes down to relative national strength. Yes, the United States has an overwhelmingly strong military on paper, with less than 1% of American population serving in the all-volunteer force at any given time, and with the capabilities of rival powers increasing every year, the question must be asked, how reliable will America's military supremacy be over time? What's more, how potent can America's comprehensive national power remain? The U.S. military itself is highly dependent on technology to amplify its relatively small size. It requires constant additional funding to upgrade its technological accoutrements, and relatively small expediency force is always being stretched. Despite the size of its budget, the military cannot keep up with current force requirements, let alone possibly take on a rising great state competitor like China, or, heaven forbid, a coalition of Eurasian powers. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates was correct when he cautioned that any future American leader who wants to fight a land war in Eurasia ought to have his head examined. But as China's comprehensive national power grows and ultimately outstrips America's, and if the United States wants to retain its dominant position in the world system, that is precisely what may happen. China's population is becoming more educated in strategically critical fields like science, technology, engineering, and math than are Americans. The Chinese are far more patriotic than their American competitors are. The Chinese infrastructure is more advanced than that of the United States of America. In the hit series Game of Thrones, the treacherous character Littlefinger admonishes the Cersei Lannister that knowledge is power. Yet Littlefinger's actual power, in spite of his vast knowledge, is insignificant. Cersei counters his quip with an actual display of military force, during which explains that power is power. In the 21st century, however, it is clear that knowledge is the basis of capabilities, and greater capabilities allow for greater power over one's rivals. This is the foundation of the CNP assessment, and why China's rise over the next decade should worry Americans today.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I saw Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're still talking about how you deal with yourself, how you are able to find life skills for the purpose of you becoming a better person individually, yourself. And therefore, in this book, Mafatih al-Hayat, on chapter number 10, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli starts to discuss an important topic which we regularly do, and that is traveling. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, "Iftatih safaraka bis-sadaqah," that you should start your trip with sadaqa. Wa aqra ayat al-kursi, and recite ayat al-kursi. Start off your trip by reciting ayat al-kursi. Now, these are among the adab al-safar. So we've mentioned making sure that it's not a safar al-ma'asiyah, it's not a sinful trip, that it's not going to entail trip, that you're not making anyone upset by you traveling, you're not going behind anyone's back, you're not disobeying your parents, or you're not disobeying your husband, you're not leaving your wife, for example, all alone because you are angry over something. You know, these kind of trips are never going to end good, let alone entailing sin. How about when to travel? One hadith says that you should travel in the nighttime. One hadith says that you should never return back to your family in the nighttime. One hadith says, this is from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, "Man kana musafiran falyusafir yawm as-sabt." You should travel on a Wednesday. Another thing that you need to observe, that besides when to travel, is what to travel with, your zad, your supplies. And there are many hadith that speak about this zad, your supplies, your provisions that you are taking. Min sharaf al-rajul, from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, from the nobility of a man, ayyutayyiba zadahu, for them to be generous. A man should be generous when it comes to their supplies that they are taking, idha kharaja fi safarihi, when they're going onto a trip. Of course, here it's talking about generosity in the sense that you should make sure that you're traveling with good quality things. There was just a point that I wanted to mention, but just hesitated as far as that is concerned. But, you know, just remembering that a person shouldn't travel, you know how we mentioned that you shouldn't travel if it's going to entail sin. You should also not travel if you know that you are, for example, under debt and the person is demanding their money from you and things like that. You know, that's just it goes without saying, pretty much, you know. But because it's mentioned here, I just wanted to quickly mention that as well.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
The hadith says that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi would always travel with certain things. He would always travel with a brush. He would always travel with a mirror. He would always travel with nail clippers. You know, he would always travel with a siwak. These are things that he always traveled with. It's recommended when you do travel, before leaving, for you to bid people farewell. While you are traveling, before you come back, for you to buy gifts for your family members, which is also a sunnah. You know, here look, the hadith says, إِذَا خَرَجَ أَحَدُكُمْ إِلَىٰ سَفَرٍ فَلْيُوَدِّ إِخْوَانَهُ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ جَاعِلٌ لَهُ فِي دُعَائِهِمْ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will answer their prayers after this person has bid farewell to his friends before traveling. The whole sunnah of a person making sure that they are reciting the dua of bidding farewell and everything else. I'd just like to mention this interesting point where it says from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that you should remember that you bid people farewell, that you are very tolerant when it comes to traveling with other people, and also وَكَثْرَةُ الْمِزَاحِ فِي غَيْرِ مَا يُسْخِطْ Allah Azza wa Jal. And that when you are traveling, you should excessively joke as well and be humorous in things, of course, that does not entail sinning Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that which will bring about anger from Almighty God. Which is an interesting point as well, you know, because, you know, usually when people are traveling, you know, they might be under a lot of stress or things like that, but there's this and numerous other ahadith that speak about how good it is for you to be humorous with those who are around you. Also, there's another thing that's important, and that is managing the group that you are with, because it's makruh to travel by yourself. So managing the group that you are with. Each person, before they leave, they all take out the expenses for that trip. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's cries.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.